Welcome back to Horse Friends. My name is Selina Skogan, and today I have not one, but even two guests. Both of them are ambassadors for equine welfare. And we are saying hello to Crispin Parelius-Johannessen and Claudia Sanders. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining today. We are a little bit international today. So I'm sitting in Norway, Claudia is sitting in Germany, and Crispin, you're sitting in southern Norway or Sweden? South of Sweden, what is very funny because you also have a connection to Tromsø, the same what I have.
Yes. I have partly grown up there.
Yes, exactly. I can understand that you moved to the south. It's a bit cold here. But that's not the topic. We don't want to talk about the weather today. We would like to talk about Crispin and Crispin's journey within the last few years in equine photography and what you have experienced being a part of the equine media. Crispin, you are a fine art photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And you are photographing on competitions, on, documenting horses. Is that correct to say? Documenting horses?
I think, I've photographed horses all my life. And I think I've got my first camera when I was 8 years old. And I remember photographing then. Then I went on to art school for 8 years. I studied, and almost all my projects were about somehow equine representation. And this was in the 90s. So there was a lot of talk about identity. So you had sort of identity politics that was talking about, male representation of different ethnicities, and also then animals and horses. So I came from a very sort of, you could say, I've always been working with these visual projects, and I see myself as a professional photographer, a fine art photographer, even though I do not earn my main money from the horse sports. I started going, I also have ridden a lot and trained a lot, and I've worked with horses now for 30 years full time. That has been my main profession. And in the late 90s, I started photographing a bit of warm-ups. And then, but it wasn't until maybe 2008, 2007, around there, when the Roll Cue debate was really, really kicking off, that started really photographing the warm-ups a lot. And I see it as that I'm documenting, yes. I do what artists do. You make a visual project and you present it to the viewer, and then they can either, they can do what they want with it and discuss with it. So for me, it's about creating documentation. And later I can now even see that, that what I'm actually documenting, often people say that I'm taking bad photographs. For me, saying that something is a bad photograph is an interpretation. It could be good or bad, but it's an interpretation. But what I'm doing, there's a fly irritating me so much. What I'm doing, I see, is that maybe I'm documenting the horse's life, what's happening to the horse, and more I'm focusing a lot on indicators that could be used in sort of welfare assessments or any kind of assessments. But maybe I see it a little bit more like that.
So are you mainly doing photographing on eventing or also just private photographing with horses, or can I book you for taking pictures from me?
As an artist, you can book, and I do occasionally do that, but it isn't what I want to do. I mean, I work with visual projects, so I also have done and a lot of them take several years. Like, I've been documenting horses living in different living conditions, and I maybe have like 200,000, 300,000 of them. I recently did a project which was about what horses eat, photographing them eating, because if you look at the sort of equine representation through several thousand years, the oldest representations we have are over 30,000 years ago. So, we have been looking and making pictures of horses for a very long time. If you look at The total of that, there's very, very few pictures of horses eating, and particularly of what they are eating. And compared to humans, there is much, much more. So I think that is kind of interesting. And I suppose it's because of my background as well. I come from a very critical fine art background. And I think this is what a lot of people perhaps get a bit confused with me, because art for them, or horse art, is sort of nice paintings with lots of mane and curly necks. And this is, of course, not what I do. I come from a very critical fine art background where you're looking into visual culture. You know, I'm questioning what is being seen, what is not being seen. How can we change visual culture or bring awareness to visual culture? And how can we bring out sort of problematic issues, conflicts? So for me, that is how I'm educated, and that is my project. So for me, I don't know, I'm not a photographer, not a commercial photographer, basically.
Yeah. So you are independent and you are making your projects and doing what is important for you to document. Showing horses in all different aspects of life and documenting equine welfare.
I think there's many things I could talk about there. I think documenting the horse's life is probably, you know, and I'm always trying to find out who the horse is. Mm. For me, this is, you know, who are you really? And who would you want to be? And I think I'm going to put in something here, which I normally don't mention, but if you look at identity politics from the 90s and representation, it's a lot of it is about misrepresentation. So you had the history of female representation, for example, the representation of women, that they were being misrepresented, pornography, for example, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's very much about how do you want to be represented? I'm gay. So, you know, gay representation is also mm-hmm. often very, very misrepresenting, or you talking in stereotypes, you're trying to make someone into something else than what they really are. You're trying to show them as being someone else than what they really are. Now, for me, horses are, I see that they are really subject to this treatment. I think we don't, this is an opinion, of course, but, you know, a lot of representation tries to make them what we really want them to be rather than who they actually might be.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, this is about, I don't think there's no way you would get me to say that I photograph horses like they really are, or I photograph horses like they really are not. It's more about just trying to find out and using it and thinking critically around sort of issues of representation and what that means.
Yeah, but that was exactly the point where I wanted to go, because I wanted to get a wider background. You are not only standing and doing competition photos, you are actually really interested in the horse.
Absolutely.
As a whole being, as who the horse really is. And I can just speak from my personal journey that moving to Norway and rewilding my dressage horses has been, yeah, not only creating a mind shift, but also, you know, some of the dogma you're growing up with when you're in the equestrian world has been just simply resolving. And then you see your horses living in a natural habitat and behaving like half wild horses, and you think, oh, okay, why haven't I seen that before? So I think when you're meeting on this level, then you're getting a different feel for who are you? What is your identity? What do you want to be? What would you like to be? Where are you agreeing? Where are you disagreeing? Where can we communicate?
Mm. And what I think, because I also, I work with real life horses and I have clients and what I can see, that, and that was a big shift for me also, was when I started living with horses 24/7. And you can hear them very close to the house, and you can experience what they are doing at night and all of these. And that's when you make the shift. So I started, I spend a lot of time photographing horses living in different living conditions, amongst others in nature reserves. And there are a lot of other different things we are wanting to find out about as well. So I spend a lot of my time photographing hooves, as I see that as being quite an You know, that's quite an important indicator of many things with how the horse's life.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I didn't have anything.
Okay. No. It was just that when you're talking about your journey there, it feels a little bit similar to mine, though you were in it so much longer than me, that we are getting interested in more and more details. The more we are seeing the identity of the horse and who are you as a person, as a horse person, as a character, I am starting to look at fur patterns. I'm starting to look at what actually happens in the structural body if I'm changing the nutrition, if I'm changing the hoof treatment, if, you know, all these small details. So I'm getting this micro focus, and I'm starting to dive into this very, very deep.
And if I should just comment on the fact that you're picking up on details, I might just take the opportunity to talk about that. If you look at the history of equine representation and details, and then it's details like I see horses eating and you can see what they are actually eating. That's a detail. And then you see the horse's mouth with the bit in it. So there's a lot of details around the horse's mouth, for example. But if you look at these, the sort of history when photography is introduced in sort of the 1870, and I talk a lot about Muybridge, but I mean, he's not the only one, but he was the really big, if you look at a really big shift in how we look at the world and how we use technology, it actually was directly related to horses, which I think is quite funny, because it was Edward Muybridge photographing the racehorses to try to see the detail of if all the legs of the horse were off the ground at the same time. So people have heard me talking about that, and I think it's just such an important shift. But I think if you look at how we look at horses today, it's very important, because you can find in certain documents, there's very little, but it's kind of indicated that the audience was really shocked when the horse was being whipped. And you can also see that the horse's mouth is open. Now, if you look at Muybridge's pictures, they are hardly detailed at all. They're more like just sort of silhouettes, and he went through different processes with them. But if you think about, I see the sort of what we're going through, what is driving in a way the way we are seeing horses, that we are precisely seeing more and more details. And it's like, what do we do with these details? And that's what you are talking about. You are dealing with those details in your way. And as technology develops, we are freezing details and looking at them and trying to understand them. And for me, this is really important to say that, you know, I see my job as freezing details or catching details that we otherwise would not notice, see. There's loads of different processes there. We really don't see the world in the same way as each other. And we certainly don't see the world in the same way as the horse. So it's kind of, you could almost call it a sort of history of exposing details of the horse. So you've had the naked eye perception for several thousand years, over 30,000 years we've been looking at horses. But now suddenly technology is developing so much that we're actually freezing details that is way different from the artist sitting painting 400-500 years ago. You know, they're still making quite detailed things of mouths and bits and anatomy. So for me, this is what's changing, is in a way that exposure of details of the horse's life.
How many pictures, when we are talking about the evolution of technology, how many pictures can you take within a minute? Do you know that by heart?
Within a minute, I don't know, but I'm quite excited about my camera at the moment, because it's a Z8, which is like the, a Nikon Z8, which is the same camera as the Nikon Z9, but in a smaller body, but it's the same camera. And you can actually, I haven't counted exactly, but I mean, supposedly if you go down, you can't take a lot of raw pictures. There you can only take, I don't know what it is, maybe 10, 12 or whatever, so it's fairly standard, maybe a bit more than that. But if you go down to quite small JPEGs, you're actually up in 120 a second.
Wow.
So, you know, that if you then say that, wow, before You weren't, not many years ago, you would be taking 10 a second. So just multiply that with the amount of seconds in a minute, and then you just see, you know. And this is, I love this, because we're going back to Muybridge again. It's this thing between the still images, you're freezing, you're looking at detail, you can see, you can spend hours looking at the same detail, and then you reanimate it into many. And I love working with this with my new camera. It's just amazing, because every, even though you just got, you know, one short sequence, I might, you know, I have several hundred. The camera stops at a certain point because it can't cope any seconds with taking that, so it does stop. But you have a sequence that maybe has like 500-600 images over a few seconds. And they're so different. So for me, this is totally new way of, talk about seeing detail like you have not been able to see before. And it's so important to be able to actually sit and spend time at this, you know, go back, zoom in, go back. And I'm going to give you a small example, which shocked me and I thought was a bit embarrassing, actually, to be honest, was about, you know, when I got really interested in faces and not mouths, I've been interested in for years, but I'd never really been taken, you know, tongues to the degree I had. And then comparing the gum to the tongue and the colors, and, you know, comparing the thickness of the tongue, it goes from filling up with loads of blood to no blood. Then I've been going back, which I often do. I'm going back having to look at pictures that are from different years. And already just last year, were some pictures that I had taken, and I didn't see how discolored the tongues were then when I was sitting looking at them. So this just goes to show how our perception, we're basically seeking out what we want to see, or various sort of strategies of our brain has of perceiving the world. But you know, I had a real shock when I saw how discolored a lot of the tongues were that I took last summer, and how my knowledge and perception has changed during the winter now, where I've spent several hundred hours looking at like 150,000 pictures.
And now I need to frame this and give a little bit of background, because I guess not everybody knows that a part of the work that you are doing is being a professional photographer on different events. And you have been publishing now several of your pictures, not only recently, but over the years, about exactly this topic, about exactly this detail that we see a lot of, horse tongues that are discolored, that are blue, when we are looking at that into detail. We have a very recent article in the Aftonbladet in Sweden. We will link the article in the show notes here, that everybody can follow that up. And for me, it is very interesting also, because when we two were just having a cup of coffee together and discussing, that in general, it was never your intention to go out and photograph blue tongues. That was just something that happened during the process and became visible. Yeah, and we just had a big summit about equine welfare and pain. It's like one of these details that once you are seeing it, you can't unsee it anymore. And suddenly you see it everywhere.
So I actually there's a chapter in a book, Equine Consciousness in Transition, which I spent quite a lot of time on that chapter where I talk a lot about this. Because there is an aspect, one aspect is that you can't unsee it once seen. And the other aspect is until you know it, you often don't see it. You know, we normally talk about that you don't believe it until you see it. But the fact is that you often don't see it until you actually believe it either. So I might just say that, I mean, there was a period where I started around 2008, 2009, I just thought the cameras that were coming onto the market then were just so much different than, you know, they were getting really good. And I did do press accreditation quite a lot. And in that process, it was the thing of sitting with these really so much better cameras that you realize the detail. And I came to this revelation that I was just like seeing, you see sperm marks, you see so much. And I was starting to photograph this more and more, and also just the sort of movements. And what I experienced was that I didn't fit in any longer with the accredited press. And I found they were really, really sensitive to the fact that, for example, I shoot my camera between jumps instead of just over the jump. They are really sensitive to that. With dressage, it's much less problematic because you tend to sort of be able to photograph all the time. And I also got into this thing that there's just out of all those sort of thousands of possible photographs you could end up with and show, it's just the press is really after an extremely little of them. But this was when I became this sort of person that I was photographing everything and wanting to look at the photographs which weren't in the horse sports convention. And I think this is really important to understand. The horse sports have a very strict convention that started with Muybridge in 1870. You have an editorial control. And I would argue that over many years now, we've been it built up this sort of a culture of editing photographs, choosing, getting rid of the ones you don't want to see. And there's a sort of written there's a sort of understanding between which ones we can show and which ones we can't show. And I sort of quickly started feeling like the photographer that I was being exposed as the one that was taking the pictures that you can't show. And I felt that you should show a lot of these pictures because I did want to people to look at them and see, you know, can you do a welfare assessment? Do you think there's a welfare concern here? Do you know, think this is problematic? We're seeing the horse differently. So I very quickly sort of became, and since then, people ask me a lot for photographs, and I generally donate photographs to people's talks and to magazines. Yeah, I don't know if that was answering your question, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was the answer, or that was a very good answer to my question. And I have the next one for you. That means you are donating the pictures.
Yeah, I do actually donate them. And I think this is quite there's lots of different reasons to this. But I think a lot of people are willing, you know, back in sort of 2008, 2009, 2010, there was even stricter than that. Things other than the conventional horse sports photography, it just wasn't really being published. There's much more of it now. And if people sort of treated me as they did when you work as a press agent, they sort of think, okay, you can pay them €30 or whatever to get your photograph. And that really isn't what I'm doing. I am not a bread and butter photographer, horse sports photographer in that way. So in the end, it ended up that a lot of the people who are working with these issues and wanted, you know, to have photographs and share and stuff also have do not have the budgets. I don't know really where I'm going with this, but I can say that I've basically been working unpaid for
many years. Yeah,
I pay for all my travel. I pay for, and I even pay for my conferences when I go places to give talks. I'm usually paying for it all. So recently, we've tried to start crowdfunding in Norway to pay for my work, and I find it, I for me, that's a much more preferable way of going, that people are actually donating towards my work, and then I can share it to the people who need to use it, who often also don't have a budget.
Yeah, and I think that is also a part of what makes you very interesting as a person, because, or Maybe that is a part of why you have, why it's sometimes a bit difficult for you, because you are independent. And with that, there is no system and no organization that can control what are you publishing and what are you not publishing. And I expect that it will, when we're, you know, I'm a professional writer too. So if I'm having a photographer on my farm and I'm looking afterwards through the pictures, of course I'm picking the most beautiful ones and not the worst ones. Maybe that is the wrong idea. Maybe in the future we should actually also as professional writers not only publish the best ones, but also the worst ones, because that is where equine welfare matters are exposed, right? So if I would like to have a profile as a professional writer, maybe I should take the worst pictures from
I think also worse than good, their interpretations, you know. One should look at what might be an image which is the worst possible bad image for horse sports could be a really good image for a welfare assessment.
Yeah,
exactly. By a vet or something like that. So what we see today is, I think, is that it's fine. Horse sports photographers can stand at horse sports shows and do their thing and sell it to the press. But it's all these other potential images today really don't have a place to go to. Which is why, for example, the people I work with and stuff, we're sort of publishing them. You know, is it the best place to publish? Big media, small media, all these different things. But they should be going somewhere, even into, you know, if vets and ethologists and other interested parties should be doing welfare assessments, we should have a place to take this material. And it doesn't really exist today.
Yeah. I agree with you. I did that with my own pictures in the last summit and showing just beautiful and not so beautiful face expressions of my horse in the work, exposing it as a guideline for if we are training our horses and if we want to judge our own work and our own progress, look at the horse's face, use the equine grimace scale. It's not very comfortable, but I think it's a very important part of the work that we are also doing as an instructor, to just educate people to look at the eye, look at the face, and look at what is going on there, and not get blinded by a round neck or a beautiful exercise.
But photographic conventions, we all have them. The pictures behind you on the wall are also conventions. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, the convention are based on objectification. And this is what I have a problem with. We are all very, our egos at least, are very sort of willing to go into these conventions, which are highly objectifying. And we could have a much more greater diversity of details we dare to show or discuss. And this is what I find very difficult with the horses, that we reduce them. And then you can look at the blue tongue. This is, you know, you publish a blue tongue in a big media newspaper and people go crazy. But it's a detail of what was happening. It was there in front of everyone. So anyway.
Yeah. And that is exactly what has happened now. So, and that wasn't the first article that you or one of the magazines published where you were donating pictures to. But what happened now was we have this big article in the Aftenpost and Aftenbladet, I'm sorry. and Claudia has also been discussing this article in her podcast and also experienced a big blowback. And that is a moment where I would also like to invite you to the talk. If you don't know Claudia is the CEO and editor-in-chief of a German dressage magazine. Her magazine is called Dressurstudien. And for many, many years, you are in each magazine you're printing, you have a specific topic and specific equine welfare topic, and then you're collecting experts around that topic and trying to educate the equine audience. Thank you for being here. Hello, Claudia.
Thank you. First of all, I have to apologize for my broken English. So if something went a little bit crazy, you have to translate my runaway English.
Your runaway English. We will manage. We will manage fine. And we are all not native speakers. And I think that most of our audience is also not native speakers. So therefore, that will just be perfectly fine. You've been discussing in your podcast together with a friend who is also an equine professional and an expert, the article in Aftenbladet, sorry. And I actually, listening to the podcast, experienced it as a very well-balanced podcast and thought, yeah, nice. Thank you for talking about that. So cool-headed. And thank you for talking about that, from trying to involve different perspectives. But still, you experienced a lot of how shall we phrase that nicely? There were strong reactions to that podcast.
Oh, we can name it. After 3 weeks, after it was online, I received a letter from Isabel Wert's lawyer, and he demanded me to put the podcast offline because you don't want to listen to the accusations which were made in Aftenbladet. So I was supposed to ask the lawyer too what he thinks about it, if I have to put it offline, or if he thinks that we are, that I was in a well-balanced interview. And then my lawyer said, okay, come on, let it. It should be online because it's okay. It's all right. All you did was to put your opinion on air, and this is allowed. So until now, and the lawyer von Isabel Wert says that he would put us to court, that he would took a legal action if we are not going to put the cast offline. And we received 3 letters, but until now, no legal action was taken.
What has happened parallel also for our audience was that the article in Aftenbladet was published in German version in 2 big equine magazines. We had it in St. Georg and Reiter Revue. And it was also taken offline more or less in the same moment. For me, this is sounds a lot like we are trying to, or the legal position lawyers or big organizations are trying to put the issue or keep it a little bit low key, just not let it try to rise onto the surface. How do you feel about that?
First of all, we have to say the situation for the colleagues from Reiter Revue in St. Georg is a little bit different than mine, because they have shown particular pictures, and the situation was different. And I don't know if their lawyer said, oh, it would be better if you put it down. But there's another big difference between Reiter Revue St. Georg and me, because they're publishing articles for sport riders. And so they criticize sport riding sometimes, sometimes not. And this is a totally different situation, because if Isabel Wert will not give me any interview, so what? I guess the last time I asked her for an interview was in 2006. And it's a little bit ago. So this is not my audience. And this is different for Reiter Revue and St. Georg. And I guess at this moment, when we start talking about money, things getting really weird and different. And this is the reason why Crispin is so brave-hearted that he's going to donate the pictures. And so nobody can say, hey, you don't have to do this, because if you're going to publish the picture, we are not give you every more money. And this is
you don't get a job anymore. Yeah, exactly. So you can only do what you do when you are staying independent, is basically what you're saying.
Yes, that's what it is.
It sounds like there's a lot. Yeah. So I think that I am not very, I think we should not discuss a particular person, because I think it's a general issue. It's not person related. And when I'm looking, I did something similar as you. I didn't go to Getty Images. I just have a Canva account. And when you're going to Canva and you search through their database of photography, it was very, very difficult to find a healthy horse. It was nearly not possible. I gave a lecture about a fitness test last week. So I was searching for a thumbnail for my presentation, and it was not possible to find a healthy horse in the stock images. A horse without a pain face and a horse without pain markers. And that, of course, is also something that has been happening within, let's say the recent decade. We've just been talking in my masterclass about science and pseudoscience and how are we finding also equine welfare markers. And we did a PubMed research. And what was very interesting is that if you're looking at the last 10, 15 years, there has so much happened in equitation science, in equine science, in behavioral science. You see that we have an increase after 2010, an increase in publications to the topic around equine welfare. So what I'm wondering about is, did the writing get worse? Or are we getting more aware? It's a difficult question, isn't it?
Yeah, but because I guess it's a little bit the last point will be the reason we get more aware. We can see much more details. Just as Crispin told us, if you have a camera which can make 120 pictures in a second, there are things you can't even see with your own eyes. Just the camera is able to identify this. And in the moment, and this is what you said too, in the moment you realize this thing there, you can't no longer ignore it, then you see it clearly. And I guess we have the problem not only with the sport riders, we have the problem even with the riders who are not doing sports,
but riding.
And so in my opinion, we have to find out, or we have to make, there's a big lack of knowledge. Maybe sometimes because people are going to ignore it. Maybe some sports riders are doing it, and maybe some not sports riders are doing it. The lack of understanding of the behavior of the horse, of stress, of all these things, what you have done in your Equidemia Congress. We have to do a lot more work on this to make much more people aware what's going wrong.
Yeah, on the other hand, it is leading us to a shift of paradigm. And that is a very good thing. And I would also, so the last question for you, Claudia, how have you, you're a dinosaur in the industry, so you're doing the Dressurstudien already for a very long time. Do you feel that within the last decade or in during your years you were working with that, were there changes?
Not real changes, but we have changed the names for it. Just remember the FEE conference in the year 2010. I was one of the heads behind the Norolco petition. And we have collected about 42 signatures to give it to the veterinarian Gerd Heuschmann to go to this conference, to the FEE conference. Mm. At this time, we have talk about Rollkur, and at the end of the conference, we talk about low, deep round, which was allowed for 10 minutes. So they have changed the name, but actually, nothing really has changed at all. They are maybe a little bit more aware in the public that we don't want to see it, so they try to hide it. But as you can see, then we get to other details, like the blue tongues, which are a sign for a hard riding, a bad riding. No, I don't think, you see, I'm a little bit pessimistic, actually. I'm within this business for 20 years next year, and I see that we have changed the names, but we didn't have changed anything which will be better for the welfare of the horses. Some things are better because we know we have more scientific evidence. The people get aware that horses need to get out in the fields. This is better, but the riding, it will take us much more time, I think. Sorry, I don't find any optimistic point of views because I've seen it the last years. Different names, different riders, sometimes not always, but the problem was not solved.
We are always hearing this this story about that years ago or 50 years ago, everything was better. And this is something that I'm really questioning. Was it better? Were the horses healthier? Were the technique worse? Or I'm not really sure. And I would like to invite you back to the discussion, Crispin, because I know you did your research there also, and you have been showing a lot of historical pictures in one of your presentations. Was everything better? It was earlier?
Yeah, I often talk about it, and there's many different ways of talking about it. But when Claudia and I was talking, I think one of the examples I occasionally think about is, which I see taken up, is that you often see videos of Klimke riding Alarich. And people go, oh my God, isn't it wonderful? And then it's like, yeah, but the quality of the video is so bad that you can't see anything. You know, if you're going to look at the color of a tongue, you have to see the tongue. You can't see the tongue on those videos. Well, what you can see, of course, it's different what you can see. You could, for example, see him hyperflexing. That's quite easy to see. And I think you can go back in history and look at painting, and you'll see what could people see with the naked eye. They can't see hyperflexion. They paint hyperflexion. They can see a mouth open. They paint a mouth open. But you can't see the color of the tongue. You can't see spur marks. You can see kind of jabs like that. So I'm not saying that Klimke wasn't a good rider. I mean, I saw him live several times as well. But I think you have to be able to see. And that is the problem with assessing the past a lot, is that we can't see with the documentation we have. It's not sufficient quality or sufficient to see. And we don't know really what people saw. And my... yeah, so that's... we don't have the documentation, so it's not that easy to actually answer that question, but we do have. But then I think also, if from my own perspective, I think it's getting... it's changing. I'd definitely say that it's getting much worse. And like Claudia said, I mean, that period 20 years ago when Rolkir was discussed a lot, and then in 2010, the difference between the LDR and Rolkir came, and you go through these phases, it's like again and again. And what I see a lot is that people join the debate, and then they get really engaged, and they're going to create change, then nothing happens. And then they get totally disillusioned, overwhelmed, and disappear. And then you have certain people who are sort of staying in for every wave. And now I've sort of done it so long that I can see that, okay, we're going into a new wave now where people believe there's going to be change with the FEI. And then we sink and the people disappear. And then a new load of people come in. So I think there are variations to the theme. And I think things... And I'm just going to quickly add here that I really had hoped, because the quality of the images is so much, and this, I took 120,000 pictures in Amsterdam and Neumünster. Let me tell you, no one has really asked to see them. Nobody. I mean, it's almost like it's nobody even asks me how many pictures there are. Nobody asks me how many pictures of blue tongues I have. They just want this story to be that it was one or two. That's what they want. We offered the FEI to come and show, the journalist Susanna Nygren and I offered the FEI to come and show them the documentation. And they didn't say yes to that. Okay.
So, and Let me say this. I guess everything has its time. So after we have made the big petition, it runs until 2012, I think. And after a while, I said, okay, everybody is tired seeing the pictures of the abused horses. And maybe it's a better way to show the people and the methods which are fine for the horses, which are good for the welfare of the horses. And this was the point that I said, okay, come on, let's start to look for people who are doing a good job with the horses and put them mm-hmm. in the foreground. And now, how long is it ago that Eva is on the Tribune? Three years, Eva Avament, you have been at the Congress, Crispin.
Yeah. How long is it that she has what?
That she appears 3 years ago.
No, it's a little bit longer than that, 5-6 yeah? years.
Okay.
That's yeah. what I think about 5 years ago, she sort of, yeah.
And she was probably the next wave.
Maybe it always needs someone who has fresh energy, you know, for running the next campaign. But in general, we are all tired of seeing. I'm always trying to separate in between bad riding or abusive riding, because when we are really, I have to in my profession, I have to strongly believe that people are not getting up in the morning and saying, and today I'm doing a really bad job with my horse, but that everybody is trying to do the very best. And then sometimes we have a lack of knowledge. But what we also, and that is a very big difference also, to see really abusive methods. And that is what we are seeing in the media over and over again, abusive methods. And then we are having horses who are in discomfort because they are having a hidden lameness. But what we are talking about here now is really abusive methods in riding. Sorry.
You know, I just wonder at which point we can talk about an abusive method. In the moment when somebody is standing with a horse beside me, please stay alive, Celina. If somebody is standing with his horse beside me and he says, oh, the horse is in a bad mood, the buck is stubborn. So this means somebody ignores completely what the horse needs in this moment. Is this abusive too, or isn't? Or do we talk about
that? That's a very good question. And I think that is also something I would like to discuss with you too, because where is it starting? Where do we say, do we have a lack of knowledge? And where do we say we have an abusive method, or we are having methods that we simply, because I always think, you know, we can't discuss about riding styles. Everybody has their own religion there, but we can talk about equine welfare. Equine welfare is undiscussable. We have scientific scales where we can measure equine welfare from. We have pain ethograms, different ones. We have proof. We have, you know, there we can be very objective and say, of course, it is undiscussable that a horse needs to be able to breathe. Simple. That's not discussable. What we can discuss about is if you're wearing a black jacket or a blue one, if you're having a Western saddle or a trekking saddle or a dressage saddle, I don't care. What I do care about is my horse able to breathe? What I do care about is, can my horse chew? Can it swallow? Does it have sufficient blood circulation in all of its body parts? Can it show its natural gaits, or is it getting a muppet? That is equine welfare. And if I'm putting a horse into shapes, into even by using tools, especially by using tools, what kinds of tools are we using? Like looking at the videos that we recently saw on Facebook also with different people there and putting the horses in different strings, there we can very clearly say, okay, and here we are not talking about riding quality. This is very clearly abusive methods, and I'm not sure why it is named like this.
This was a question.
Yeah, it's just putting it out. It's a conversation. It's not.
But just when you think about all the many videos you can see on Instagram or Facebook, which is thousands of likes where a horse is bucking around the Halle Platz.
Riding arena,
thank you for the words. And the people say, oh, it's funny. And she stays on the horse. And I think the whole time, what the fuck? They think it's funny. It's not funny. If a horse is doing this, there's always a reason for it. And it's not the reason because the horse thinks it's fun moving like this. This is crazy. This is probably not an abusive method like Rollkur or low deep round, because these abusive methods are trained on purpose. Yeah, it's not something which happens eventually.
Yeah, that's. But we are ending up at the same point again, where I'm usually ending up when I'm having a discussion like this, where I'm thinking that a part of the problem is simply also that we don't understand species-specific behavior.
And I think this is correct. And I'm going to kind of answer another question, but I'm going to look at, so we have development in science with the ethograms and knowledge of how to interpret. With the use of ethograms and the right to interpret, I think there's a lot of mechanisms, you know, that one has to be aware of there with perception. What Claudia was indicating there is, or maybe not, if we are interpreting something, there's a lot of economy involved. There's a lot of probably some level of politics. There's certainly a lot of power in who's allowed to define the interpretation of a horse's behavior. And that, I think, is what is really problematic, is that you see these fights, that means that. And then you have these bucking videos and these horrible, horrible videos a lot of the time where people are just laughing and they're just celebrating. And for me, it's almost a little bit like that with the blue tongues as well, sitting there in the, looking at the horses, photographing them, and I'm looking at the camera at the same time, this blue tongue, and people are cheering, going crazy. So that I would say that about interpretation. But what I think is changing a lot here, which is for me very useful to think about, is that you have the science developing. For science to develop, you need technology to be able to see more. And one of the real problems that has... But the horses, I think the media has really had editorial control over what we see. And I think that's really, really important, that if you don't see something, you don't know that it really exists. And if you're standing at a show with your friend looking at the warm-up, there's so much the eye cannot get. And that was what frustrated me, that all of these images that really should be seen and should be used, they weren't being seen. If you try to show them, you are shamed. And that went on for years with me. I was just shamed and excluded, you know, really excluded from the press room, excluded from loads of scenarios as the one who was showing these pictures. So I think what really has changed things is social media. So the equine industry, or the equine media, the equine industry, call it that, loses control over the equine image, because now we are seeing so many more images. And that is what is really crucial here, is that they have lost control over the equine image. Totally. But that in itself is okay. Because if you're not interpreting it and you don't have any knowledge and you're not aware of how you're perceiving it, we'll still sit long. Laughing our heads off at looking at horses bucking their rider off. But this is where technology sort of increases and is just showing us more and more and more, more detail. And then you can't control this detail on social media, but it still doesn't necessarily mean that much. I actually don't understand why there is so much fuss of why they say there's accusations with the Aftonbladet publication, because the such we are just showing details. It's just that we are showing non-conventional horse sports details in a horse sports context. But the other thing is then you add to that, you lose control over the viewing space with social media, technology increases, and then you get the scientific. And when you combine those three, that's what I think is going to create real change here. Because there's no way you can operate with your social license to operate with those three when they are really combined. So this is why they still try to keep separating these things.
What is not possible, basically. I mean, if we are realistic, that is not possible. And that is also what keeps me hopeful, because I think that with the progress in technique, with what people can see, and I really liked, I have been doing a little bit of research online. And if you're okay with it, I will also ask your YouTube lectures in the show notes. You have been doing some train your eye series where we can see pictures in movement, meaning video. And then you took stills out of these pictures and zooming in and saying, can you see it now? Can you see it now when we are having a video in movement? Can you see this detail now? Because, you know, it's not so easy to see at first sight if you aren't, if your eye is not trained, if your eye doesn't know what it is looking for. And also we have to say when, I'm sorry, your answer first.
If you don't have a concept of it, I mean, if you look at brain research and perception, if you don't have a concept of something, it's actually really difficult to see it. So this is my idea that you have to have, this is why it's so important to see all this multitude, diversity, and diverseness of the images, because you need to have concepts before you can see it with the naked eye. So that, you know, for example, if the chin touches the chest, that's really hard if you don't have a concept of it. You don't even know what it goes so fast. But once you've seen a lot of photographs with chins touching chests, your brain, your perception actually gets sharpened, and you actually think, you can't say for sure that you can do only, that's why documentation is so important. I think, can I just add one thing? And I think Claudia wants to say something, and I know I'm talking a lot, but there is one thing about these waves of things coming mm-hmm. and going. Mm-hmm. And one thing you could say, yes, it's great that it's new energy coming in and things. But what frustrates me a lot is that it's growing old and being an older person also, that if you always mm-hmm. think it's the new thing, I think they get there's a lot disappearing at the moment. You know, I see a lot on social media that people are saying, yes, now that the criticism has started of the sports. And it's like, what? The criticism has started of the sports? This started at least, you know, you could argue probably maybe 400 years, but at least for the past 20, if not 30 years, there's been massive criticism of the sports. And it's like, and people talk about the Hellström documentary, now that it's been exposed, what? I mean, look at what has been going on for years. And that is the problem when you just look at one wave and isolate it and disappear. And I wish, for example, the Hellström documentary could have, you know, included a slight sort of historical timeline there, and it would have changed our perception of it totally. Instead, it's just seen that, oh, yeah, anyway.
I would like to mention another aspect, because you have said, Crispin, and you are absolutely right, that we have to train our eyes to see details. But on the other hand, our eyes get used to pictures, for example, riding behind the vertical. Show me a picture of a horse who's not riding behind the vertical. It's raw. And the next thing is, for example, fat horses. Most of the horses we are seeing today are too fat. And if somebody comes around the corner with a normal horse, everybody says, oh my God, it's so thin. So, and this is the other way our eyes get used to something. And here we have to go and to find a change too, somehow.
That we are getting used to pictures. Yeah. Yes. You know, it's starting actually very early. I had this discussion in a totally different context, but when we are looking at the horse in pop culture, When I'm looking at the comics that my baby girl or my little girl here is watching, you will see that most of the horses that are shown on TV in Disney comics, whatever, they are not showing a clean walk. They are showing pus, showing clean amble. And of course, if you are growing up with this, and I mean, of course, the people who are sitting there producing that, they are not trainers, they are not riders. They are just, you know, looking at YouTube or something else, and then they are catching a movement there and making a picture of it. So what is happening there is having the effect is multiplying, right?
Of course. So if you're not seeing a correct ridden horse, where the head is in front of the vertical or at the vertical, and the most of the time you're seeing the horses with the heads behind the vertical, then it's getting normal. So the eye is getting used to it. And this is a big problem too. On the one hand, like Crispin said, we have to train our eyes to see the details. And on the other hand, we have to be carefully that our eyes will not get used to pictures which are not real, which are not right, and which are not good for the horses.
I think if you look at sort of what I was talking about a little bit earlier as well, with identity and representation, you see that, for example, images maybe 30 years ago of women might have been what was normalized then and we thought was okay or didn't react to, would not be okay now. So I guess it does, what I think is interesting is this idea of when does it turn into propaganda in a way. But I think these things are very, very difficult. And when it comes to the flexion of the neck, we have been seeing, I mean, hyperflexed horses for hundreds, if not thousands of years in representation. So the hyperflexed neck is not new. And then we have these periods which are with photography, maybe around 50s, 60s and 70s, you see a lot of horses in front of the vertical. And then recently it's just totally exploded that you can't see anything behind the vertical, in front of the vertical.
In front.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think that is quite a difficult question. When does it turn into a sort of, and when do you go out of it?
It's a very difficult question. If it would be easy, I guess if it would be easy, it would be answered already, but it isn't easy. And Claudia said that she is experiencing, or what she feels is a big lack of knowledge, a massive lack of knowledge.
I have a question for Claudia actually about this, because I think it is really, really interesting. And at the last talk ever von in Paris as well, Christine Stuckelberger was there. And I think people like Christine Stuckelberger are really interesting to ask questions to, because they remember more clearly, or they remember a different time. And I think for us, a lot of going back and looking at photography is kind of difficult there. I think it is also, you know, a lot of these horses you see that are in front of the vertical, but they're also with very lowered, they're unparalleled legs and they've got lowered backs. But in Germany, I kind of think that there is a lot of source material here. And I would like to know, and this is kind of a answer to a question to you, Claudia, is when do you think it became socially acceptable to show horses in behind the vertical? I'm sure it was a period, but do you think in the 50s and 60s it was actually, from a media, in a media, it was unacceptable to show it? Because you don't see much photography behind the vertical then at all. Do you understand my question, Claude?
Yes, I understand your question. I'm just looking for the words. But as far as I know, the person who bring up the riding behind the vertical was Plinzner. And he lived in 1800-something. And he was a teacher of the last Kaiser in Germany. And this Kaiser had a broken hand or a bad hand.
He was disabled
to ride. And so Plinzner was supposed to make these horses so safe for this man that he could ride them always. And so he started a method which is nothing else than Rollkur. And at this time, they called it Plinznan. So this, yes, which is nothing else but Reukur. And within the years, I guess the first time we have it then back in sport, in the dressage sport in Germany, was in the late 80s and in the beginning of the 90s. That's what I found out.
And do you think it went hand in hand then, that we started seeing more images of it? Because I sort of was a teenager in the 80s and learning to ride then and training. And it was really not acceptable to ride very much behind the vertical. I mean, we were quite sort of vigilant with that. So there, I think perhaps there is a certain propaganda, if it is developing out of there, that there is a gradual... when I was in Neumünster, they had a photo exhibition in the Neumünster Halle where the competition was of, which I thought was really interesting, of sports horse photography, obviously related to Schleswig-Holstein and the Holstein, but it was in the Neumünster Halle, but you saw photos from what could have been the earliest ones, but it was kind of 60s and 70s at least. And what was really good at seeing that you saw how the technological, the quality of the images develop and how different it was what you can see. And there I lost it. Oh, I felt I talked a lot and I lost my point about that. I was going to.
I think we got your point. With the increase of technology, we could see more details.
No, but it's with behind the vertical, it's really easy to see, and you know, there are even woven pictures from like 600 years ago where the horses are touching, so that there is a convention of that. And I think what my kind of question here is to which extent does someone try to normalize something in visual imagery, knowingly trying to legitimize what they do? Because that is the real question. And I think certain of their equine press, I know at least a couple of photographers and journalists which show pictures that really are probably quite socially unacceptable, but they really frame it into an acceptable frame and context. And this, I think, is a kind of way of manipulating and I think, you know, you can show whatever you want. It all depends on how you frame it and present it and the context of it. You know, there's nothing wrong in it. We're not that easy to brainwash that we see pictures and then immediately think it's normal. I mean, you can actually show pictures and ask questions.
But then you have to know what normal is, right? You can only discover what is anormal or abnormal when you know what normal is.
Yeah, you need to compare.
And I think this is part of the problem with the horse thing, isn't it? Is that this is why we have to ask who is the horse, because we don't really know necessarily what is normal, and we certainly don't agree about what is normal. And if you look at, for example, you know, what is normal is perhaps constantly changing and being redefined and changing, and there's power behind it. So if I want to introduce behind the vertical as being the new normal, I'm going to make sure that I sort of filter out lots of images. This is a kind of a little bit what I think about with horses living in nature and biodiversity. You know, I see it as slightly sort of propaganda that, you know, you give out images of horses living in different living conditions to evoke this. But I do think it is
I can just, one of my students is always saying, when she's coming and visiting me up here in Norway, she's always saying something that kind of left a mark, because she says that, you know, I am getting so much communication here from my horses, and also so much facial expressions, because the pressure is so low. And then we are not only talking about the pressure in riding, but also about the pressure in the natural environment, in their, how are they living? How is the habitat? And that is something that I'm experiencing during my during my career, because the higher the stress level or the pressure level is, independent of the writing style, independent of the writing technique, but just also in the surrounding, the less communication we get and the more of the subtle signals we are missing, and the opposite way around. We are lowering that, and the threshold for communication is much lower. And we have these, we have many studies about that horses are hiding pain signals, are hiding communication from their caretakers. And I'm experiencing here the other phenomena now, that one of my youngsters who is not fine. I don't know what is going on with him, but just doing a little bit of walking with him, no bending, no standing, no shoulder in, no riding, no nothing, walking. When I'm walking outside with him in the countryside, he's totally fine. When I'm taking him on a riding arena with a halter and a lead rope and no additional requests, he's not fine. So after 10 minutes of walking on the riding arena in this framed environment on circles where he has to be, where his body is exposed to a low degree of bending, he's showing a pain face. And people, I have been talking about that too, are starting to mock me and saying, I'm starting to get too picky. I'm thinking, no, this is actually where welfare issues are starting. I need to react on my horse's communication there. I mean, I can train that away. I'm skilled enough as a professional to overtrain that and say, okay, we are doing bending anyway. I'm putting a tool on your head and then we are doing it anyway. But the pain face doesn't disappear, right? So this is a point where I need to start learning and where I need to look at and where we are doing research of what the fucking hell is wrong with you.
Well, this is the simplest way everybody can start by his own, to have a look at his own horses and how the expression of the faces is.
Yeah, facial expression, I think, is a very good marker. And when you are talking about, we have a massive lack of knowledge, and I totally agree with you. You know, in my chest there is two hearts beating. One is for equine welfare. And then even if we have the perfect equine welfare surrounding, the moment we would like to handle a horse, we still need education. We need to learn how are we doing that. And I strongly believe that as soon as we are putting a fence around the horse, we need to handle them. We need to do something with them that are not bored to hell. And we need to learn to do that in an ethical way. Where can we start? Where can we start learning?
We are right in the middle of it.
Yeah. I guess so. We are right in the middle of it. Yeah. We are shifting paradigm, and that is actually what keeps me hopeful, where I am looking into a more positive future than you do. What keeps me hopeful, because I also think, you know, when you're comparing Facebook and Instagram, for example, I experience different generations, and with that a different wording and different perspectives. And at least in my Instagram bubble, I see a lot of fantastic accounts who are trying to do exactly that, educating us in equine welfare, educating our eyes.
I would quite like to add here that I think there are a lot of problems, issues with our perception here, actually. And that is that there is the criticism from, for example, the elite horse sports is that people are overinterpreting images and how can you see what there is in it? And to a certain extent, there is a certain truth in that. And that is that images in themselves or documentation does not tell you, you know, seeing a pain face is our interpretation. interpreting what it means is our interpretation. And I do think in the horse world, it is particularly a bit little focus on perception and how faulty and problematic human perception is, and that we are actually not very good at looking and seeing. So I'm quite hopeful here that I think there is a lot of research already. I think there is a lot of knowledge. I think a lot of this is not coming out because of the power and the culture in the horse world. There's a lot of economic forces that doesn't want certain knowledge to come out. But what I think we need to have more of in welfare is what I believe they call validating welfare markers or welfare indicators up against what they do mean in a scientific way. And there is a huge work to do. For example, the discussion around the blue tongues, there's very little you can talk about scientifically. With hyperflexion, there's a lot more, but with blue tongues. So that this whole thing of validating the welfare markers with scientific research, I think is, I hope to see more of, so that there is a problem when we are just looking even at our own horses or just images on, we do have to have a certain skepticism towards our own means of perception. I would like to ask Claudine, what kind of knowledge would you like to see being developed?
I guess what would be wonderful would be a kind of guideline above all riding styles, no matter if you're a Western rider or a dressage rider, where we give the people the signs when a horse is stressed, when it's angry, when a horse is too fat, so that it's getting ill. This would be a kind of beginning. Actually, we all have this knowledge, but sometimes I've got the feeling as more internet opportunities we have, so less the real knowledge is. So you go to a Facebook group and somebody comes around the corner and has the right idea for a horse who's walking, and you're reading this and think, what the hell is going on? Yeah. So you have so many opportunities to get knowledge, and you have so many opportunities to ignore it. Maybe it would be nice to have a kind of guideline. I have to think about it, but yeah.
And equine welfare and guideline.
And as we I'm speaking with Germans. One of the guidelines which was developed for the stewards by the German Equestrian Federation, I've spent so much time and I talk about it and I look at it, and that is for me, that's almost like how not to make a guideline, but you could look at it and develop it. So that because I think it's precisely what I'm doing, this kind of, if we are going to have guidelines to indicate to us, to help us perceive the horse, but the German Equestrian Federation, I'm just quickly going to say, there's just so much of different things the steward is supposed to be looking at. It's blue tongues, it's chin against chest, and then it's, and it's just totally impossible. And I have sat and I've marked out which ones I believe you can see with the naked eye, which one you can only see through photography. And the whole thing is, there's one or two stewards standing by the arena. There might be up to 10 to 15 horses, and they are supposed to be following all of this, while five judges in the main arena cannot see. It would seem to me, at least, that they cannot see a blue tongue when they are, five people are watching one horse, and there you have one to two stewards watching horses. And it actually says very clearly that they are supposed to intervene if there is a blue tongue. The same thing, they are supposed to intervene if there is chin to chest. You can't really see that. You can maybe think you saw it or get the feeling you saw it. So I think that is really interesting to look at the German steward guidelines from there.
Yeah, maybe you need an extra steward or two extra stewards or an extra judge who is looking only for horses' welfare and nothing else. Not for PF, not for passage, only for the horses' welfare.
Not sure if that is possible. I experience up here at least that people are judging. And, you know, we have been talking about the sports now because that was pictures that were published, but I'm pretty sure you see that at every local competition. Don't need to go into sports. You see that in every local riding arena. And I am experiencing that there's simply people teaching who... There are teachers who have no experience in equine welfare themselves, and we have judges who took a weekend course, and afterwards, they are judging. So there are more students.
Germany. In Germany, you have to do a little bit more lessons before you can.
That's good.
As a judge, but it doesn't mean anything, as we can see, obviously.
And I personally, if I should give my comment on that, I don't believe until we start documenting, it so that we can all sit and look together at the same documentation and discuss, I see this, you see that, why don't we see the same thing? That is what we have to be doing. It doesn't matter how many people you put next to the ringside, if you're not actually aware of how faulty and the pitfalls of our perception is, because we basically, it's a bit crass to say it, but we basically see what we want to see.
Yeah.
That is not good enough to secure the welfare of the horse.
I guess that is how the human brain is set up. You see what you want to see.
And we can't see good enough welfaring indicators with the naked eye. So we need documentation anyway to do that. So you can be sitting, as long as you can't see chin to chest and blue tongues and all of these things, it doesn't matter how many people are sitting looking at them. My point of photographing in the main arena was there's 10,000 audiences of people sitting at home watching on TV. There's vets there, there's judges there. No one intervenes, at least. I think people see it, but they don't intervene. And if you're going to have welfare, you have to have someone who can intervene.
And I think that was a very nice wrap up now, Crispin, of the whole conversation. And I guess we agree on that we can discuss this topic for the next 5 hours.
Yeah.
Maybe we should. But for today, I think we should close it exactly here. That was very nice last words that are hanging in our mind and where I at least will continue to chew on a little bit for today. So I'm saying thank you, Claudia, and thank you, Crispin, for being here today. And I'm looking forward to another time where we can continue this discussion.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.